Da 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 da. Vaydaber Moshe el Roshei Hamatos Livnei Yisrael Lemor Zeh Hadavar Asher Tziva Adonai Ish Ki Yidor Neder Ladonai O Hishava Shivua Lesor Isor Al Nafsho Lo yachel divoro, kechol hayotze mipiv, ya'aseh. And Moshe spoke to the leaders of the tribes of the people of Israel, saying, this is what God commands. A person who takes a vow, or swears, or in any way commits himself by his word, Lo yachel devaro, he may not profane his word, kechol hayotze mipiv ya'aseh, like everything that comes out of his mouth, he shall do. We will talk a lot about that shortly. ... Eile mas'ei v'nei Yisrael, Asher yatzu me'eretz Mitzrayim litzivosam biyad Moshe v'Aharon. And these are the travels of the people of Israel who came out of Egypt according to their marching orders at the hands of Moshe and Aharon.
Hello, I hope I haven't kept you waiting. Come right over. Ah, you're here. Good. Take the easy chair by the window. Comfortable?
Shalom and welcome to another issue of Torah Tidbits Audio. I'm your host, Phil Chernofsky, and this show is for the double portion of Matot Maseh. This Shabbat is also Rosh Chodesh benching of Chodesh Menachem Av, which will be next Wednesday. Recording and first availability, Yom Chamishi, Thursday, the 24th day, of Tammuz, 5780, corresponding this year to July 16th. We have a lot to talk about today, so we should get to it as soon as we can. But first, Tehillim Kuflamed Psalm 130. Shir hama'alot mima'amakim karticha Adonai. Adonai shima v'koli tihyena oznecha kashivot l'kol tachanunai. Im avono tishmorya Adonai mia amod. Ki imacha haslicha l'ma'an tivarei. Ki viti Adonai kivita nafshi v'lidvaro hochalti. Nafshi l'Adonai mi shomerim laboker, shomerim laboker. Yachel Yisrael el Adonai ki im Adonai ha-chesed v'harbe imo fedut. Vehu yifdeh et Yisrael mikol avonotav. Achinu kol beit Yisrael hanatunim v'atzara v'ashivya ha-omedim mebein bayam uvein bayabasha ha-makom yirachim aleihem v'yotziyem mitzara lirvacha u'me'afela l'ora u'mishibud l'geula Hashta ba'agala uvizman kariv v'nomar amen. Yehi ratzon milfonecha, shetishlach mehera refua shalema min hashamayim, refuat hanefesh urefuat haguf, l'cholei korona b'Yisrael ba'am ha-Yehudi uva'olam. Okay, let's take care of some opening show business. The little music clip at the beginning was a cappella from Schlock Rock, Lenny Solomon, from the beginning of the song on Rashi, and I will play the whole song for your modest listening entertainment within the guidelines of the 3 weeks. The psukim that I read at the beginning were the first two psukim of Matot and the first pasuk of Mas'ei. So first let me say the following. There are seven pairs of sedras. That means 14 sedras out of 54 in the Torah, which sometimes are read separately and sometimes combined. There are rules and guidelines for when a pair is combined and when it is separate. And those guidelines are not all the same. Without going into too much detail, there are four pairs that deal with the extra month during a Shana Me'uberet, where we have more Shabbatot than a Shana Pshuta, a regular year. There is a pair that deals with whether there is a Shabbat between Yom Kippur and Sukkot. I talk about Nitzavim and Vayelech, but we'll talk about that when we get to it, Amir Sashem. There is Chukat Bolak, which is the Chutz La'aretz combination that takes place every time Shavuot is a Friday here in Israel, which means it's Friday, Shabbat, and Chutz La'aretz, and that happened this year. And then there is Matot Mase. Of the seven pairs, if you were to list the statistics of how often they are combined and how often they are separated, by far the most combined pair is Matot Mase. I'll try to explain why in a moment, but I just want to say before I forget that I discovered a number of years ago a very cute, I don't know if it's more than that, a cute numeric value, a cute gematria. The first pasuk in Matot and the first pasuk in Mase'i have the same gematria. No other sedras have any gematria match in their first psukim. And to me, that says, yep, it's right that Matot and Mase'i are more combined than any other sedra. They're sort of almost fraternal twins or attached at the hip or whatever you want to call it. But this year, as in most years, Matot and Mase'i are combined. Now it turns out that the three-week period between Shivasar B'Tammuz and Tisha B'Av, being exactly 21 days, being exactly 3 weeks, will have within them three Shabbatot. Those three Shabbatot are referred to as the three Shabbatot of Puranata, of tragedy or calamity. And the best arrangement of sedras, let's put it like that, for this period is to squeeze in Pinchas, Matot and Mase'i, and Devarim. It is a given that Devarim is the Shabbat right before Tisha B'Av. We'll talk about it next week or the week after. No, we won't. We'll talk about it next week. Im Yirtzeh Hashem. And that lets Vo'et Chanan be Shabbat Nachamu right after Tisha B'Av. So the other sedras besides Devarim that are within the 3 weeks are Pinchas, Matot, and Mase'i. On the occasion, for different reasons, that Matot and Mase'i have to be split, then Pinchas is bumped, not bumped, it's the opposite of being bumped, comes right before Shivasar B'Tammuz, but it's still part of that group of sedras. Pinchas, Matot, Mase'i. So what's so unique about them, or special about them, or specific about them, that they are most 3 weeks, what's the word I'm looking for? 3 weeks, all right, I don't remember the word. It'll come to me, maybe. The answer is that each of them discusses the land of Israel, the entry of the Jewish people into the land of Israel, and the conquest and settlement of the land. And that is significant, specifically in that three-week period when we are mourning the destruction of the Beit HaMikdash, which means we are mourning the exile of Jews from the land of Israel to the various places of dispersion. After the first Beit HaMikdash, a shorter period of time since the destruction of the second period, a very, very, very long time. But it's almost as if the setters that we read give us cause to hope and to pray that the negativeness, we'll say, of the 3 weeks will not only evaporate when the land of Israel is properly settled and the Beit HaMikdash is rebuilt and the Jewish people are fully returned to their land. And that, I believe, I don't make it up myself anyway, that's why these sedras are during the 3 weeks. One of my grandchildren asked me, I don't know if I mentioned this last week, I could have, as to how come the fast days for the Churban Beit HaMikdash will become festival, Yamim Tovim. Why don't they just go away? I said that was an excellent question. And specifically on the bookends of the 3 weeks, the period in which we find ourselves now, the answer is very nice. I think I heard this answer from Rabbi Ephraim Sprecher. I could be wrong. So I don't know if there's anything wrong with giving credit to someone who's not the one to get the credit, but there is something wrong with not crediting the person. The date of Shiva Esar B'Tammuz marks the anniversary of the breaking of the Luchot by Moshe Rabbeinu, when he observed the reveling around the golden calf. And that became a day of calamity, known in the Navi as Tzom Revi'i, the fast of the fourth month, and we know it as Shiva Esar B'Tammuz. When that will evaporate, to use the same term I used before, when there's a new Beit HaMikdash in the whole era of Mashiach, Shiva Esar B'Tammuz won't go completely away because of what it should have been. Picture the Jews packed in around Har Sinai on the very first Shavuot, receiving the Torah, hearing the Aseret HaDibrot from God's mouth and reiterated by Moshe, and all of the miraculous events attached to Har Sinai, and the mutual exchange of commitment between God and the people of Israel, where he said, Vatem tiyu li mamlechet kohanim v'goy kadosh, you will be a kingdom of kohanim and a holy nation. And we said, everything that God says, na'aseh, or na'aseh v'nishma, we will do. What should have been 40 days later, when Moshe Rabbeinu came down from Har Sinai, after learning from God the entire body of mitzvot that make up the Torah, what should have been is a celebration. Shiva Esar B'Tammuz always should have been a festival, celebrating the culmination of God's giving over the Torah to the people of Israel, and Moshe Rabbeinu bringing down the engraved in stone proof of whole revelation at Sinai. But it was turned into a tragic commemoration, a tragic day. And therefore, when the tragic elements of the destruction of the Beit HaMikdash will be removed. The day will become what it always should have been, a holiday. Same thing with Tisha B'Av. Tisha B'Av, let's give an alternate scenario to it. The people ask Moshe that, yes, we know we're supposed to be going to Eretz Yisrael, Eretz Canaan, but we want to send advanced scouts. And God sort of approves of the idea, and Moshe selects leaders of each of the tribes to form the scouting party. We know them as the Meraglim. And they go on a 40-day tour of the land, following the instructions of Moshe Rabbeinu to check the quality of the trees and the quality of the cities and the type of people that there are there. And they return 40 days later. The day that they returned was Tisha B'Av, which should have been a holiday. Tisha B'Av would have been, at the beginning, the celebration of the happy news that we have no problem proceeding into the land of Israel, and we will succeed in conquest and settling, because all 12 Meraglim came back with glowing reports and very favorable attitudes and encouragement. That was an alternative scenario. Unfortunately, the reality was the adult male population panicked totally when 10 out of the 12 Meraglim spoke so negatively about the land of Israel. The generation was punished by dying out in the course of 40 years of wandering, and Tisha B'Av received its initial identity of being a sad day of tragedy and calamity. But it originally would have been a holiday. So in Yirtz Hashem, when the Beit HaMikdash is rebuilt, and there is no longer a need to mourn the destruction of the Beit HaMikdash, that aspect doesn't necessarily deserve a holiday, but what should have been on Shivasar B'Tammuz and what should have been on Tisha B'Av certainly are cause for a return to the holy days they should have been in the first place. Now let's have a listen to Schlock Rock a cappella, the song of Rashi, Lenny Solomon and his gang, a cappella.
Born in France and sent to Yeshiva, studied in Worms, and on his return he founded a school and wrote commentaries. Everyone knows it's Rashi. Whose words are written under the Chumash, the inside of every page of Talmud. Whose three daughters married great scholars. Everyone knows it's Rashi.
Ba, 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 ba.
And Rashi was so concise, and in his own script did write. And if you want to know why, just look inside.
Just look inside.
Just look inside.
Just look inside.
She was so concise, and in his own script did write.
And if you want to know why, just look inside.
Just look inside.
Just look inside.
Just look inside. Whose words are written under the Chumash, the inside of every page of Talmud. Whose readers marry great scholars. Everyone knows it's Rashi. Everyone knows it's Rashi. Everyone knows it's Rashi.
If you remember at the beginning of the show, I didn't only read the first verse of Matot, but the second one as well. Because the second one covers the Torah's in writing topic of vows, pledges, oaths, swearing, giving one's word. It makes it sound very simple. If you give your word as a commitment in any of the languages of commitment, if you do something that's good at least one time, but you know, some say three times are necessary, it becomes tantamount to a pledge. In all cases where one's word is supposed to be binding, that verse tells us, yes, it is supposed to be binding. Lo yachel devaro, he does not profane his words. Kechol hayotze mipiv yaaseh. This idea is repeated in different words with a slightly different topic in Parshat Ki Teitze, with the important operative phrase there is Motza Sfatecha Tishmor. Preserve what comes out of your mouth, what out of your lips. But that's not the whole story. The Torah continues with a portion devoted to two exceptions to that sentence, that second pasuk, the second verse. Ish ki yidor neder, if a man takes a vow, and it means a woman also, lo yachel tvaro kechol hayotze mipiv yaaseh, except, says the Torah, that a father, on the day that he hears of a vow that his 12 to 12 and a half year old daughter, who is halachically called a na'ara, she makes a vow during that time. On the day that the father hears of it, he has the power to annul it. That's not what would be indicated by kechol hayotze mipiv yaaseh. This girl, once she's over the age of mitzvot, which she is, because she's over 12, should be held accountable for every vow that she takes. Kechol hayotze mipiv yaaseh. But the Torah provides that the father of that 12 to 12 and a half year old girl has the authority on the day that he hears of the vow to nullify it. Similarly, but with differences, significant differences, a husband who hears on the day that his wife makes a vow, and by the way, it's not just hearing on the day that it happens. If he is unaware of it for 3 months, and he hears 3 months later from his wife or someone else that she made a vow 3 months ago, on the day that he hears about it, he has the authority to annul it if it has to do with him. In other words, there are certain vows that a wife will make which are her own vows, and whatever rules of vows have to be followed by her. But when a vow applies to her husband or involves her husband, the classic example is a wife swearing against having relations with her husband. That vow will complicate things if she has a change of heart. And the Torah says the husband has the authority to annul it. There are other mundane examples, but we'll leave it at that. So now we have covered pretty much what the Torah, which we call Torah Shebichtav, the written word, has to say about neder. You make a pledge, a vow, you swear, you have to keep your word. You can't profane your word. Everything that comes out of your mouth you shall do, with the exception of what is called hafarat nedarim, heife resh, hafarat nedarim, of a father of a na'ara and a husband of a wife under certain circumstances. Now, if you're not aware of where I'm going with this, you might say to yourself, wait a minute, he keeps saying hafarat nedarim. I remember it being called Hatarat Nedarim. Well, Hatarat Nedarim is not the same as Hafarat Nedarim. I will explain what Hatarat Nedarim is for those who need the explanation. It's not the same. And aside from being not the same, Hatarat Nedarim is not mentioned at all in the written Torah. It is part of the oral law, which is an inseparable part of Torah. The Torah is composed of the written word and the oral law, and you may not divide those away. Not that it hasn't been done, which we'll get to in a moment. But a true belief in Torah Misinai is that God transmitted to Moshe and Moshe to the generations, one at a time after the other, all of Torah, including the written word and the oral law. The oral law of the Torah, this is not rabbinic idea, the oral law of the Torah provides for a process where a person may convene or appear before a Beit Din of three adult Jewish males, or in our times, before a Rav, Talmud Chacham, who is an expert in the Darim and would know which ones you could get rid of and which ones you can't. And let's take the simpler example of appearing before a panel of three. You sit down, three people that could be your friends, and you say to them, I have made a pledge or a vow or I swore something, and I realize now that it's not easy to do. I didn't realize that my walking ability would be diminished, or I didn't realize that corona restrictions would make it difficult to do whatever I do. And I ask you to unbind me from that neder. They have the power to do that, provided there is a reasonable reason, a legitimate reason, for the fact that you would not have made this a vow in the first place if you realized the circumstances. There are many, many, many details, but the overall detail, it's not a detail, the overall rule of thumb, is that nidarim, vows, pledges, oaths, etc., must be echad bapev, echad balev. You have to be one in your heart and your mouth. If you feel something in your heart and you say something different from your mouth, then even if that is a real neder, it can be broken, nullified, by a Beit Din. You can't change your mind and nullify it by yourself, because the Torah says lo yachil divaro, you may not profane your word. But a Beit Din can, because it is not just the words that come out of your mouth, it is the feeling and understanding in your mind, in your heart, that manifested itself through your power of speech. Let's take an example. A person who decides to go visit the Kotel once a week, at least once a week, and he's pretty faithful to this, And then comes the rainy season, and we end up with heavy, heavy rain that makes his visit to the Kotel very difficult to do. But he has a commitment. By doing it week after week, he commits himself to visit the Kotel every week. He can apply to a Beit Din, he can appear before a Beit Din, and explain to them that at the time that he started this, it was nice weather, and he forgot to say that I'm doing this without a neder, bali neder, and he forgot to say I will go to the Kotel once a week, except in inclement weather, or except when it's too difficult to go. Based on that, his neder can be nullified by that Beit Din. That does not mean he should not continue going to the Kotel every week. What it means is that if and when he misses, it shouldn't be a serious sin and violation of Torah law. If you don't want to drink whiskey, then don't drink whiskey. If you make it as a pledge, then you're creating a new potential sin for yourself. All the rest of us Jews are not allowed to drink the milk of a camel, and not allowed to drink blood, and not allowed to eat elephant steaks, but we are allowed, in moderation, to drink whiskey. You have the same prohibitions as everybody else, and added a prohibition to yourself, which, if you break it, is sort of worse than breaking one of God's laws, because God said, well, what'd you make it a pledge for in the first place? You want to do something, do it. Now, it turns out that there are things that a person needs to encourage himself. He needs a little help, and pledges do that job, mostly for charity, tzedakah appeals, but that's a complicated question all by itself. Now, I mentioned before that the oral Torah and the written Torah are inseparable, but we have had splinter groups of Jews who have not accepted that idea, who would say the Torah in writing was given by God to Moshe at Har Sinai, and the oral law, as we see in the Mishnah and Gemara and other writings, that's totally man-made and we don't accept it. For a Torah person, this is an unacceptable position to take. You cannot understand the Torah and what God wants of us without the joint partnership of the Torah Shebichtav, the written word, and the oral law. But the Tzedokim and the Karaites, and to a certain degree the Shomronim today, although they're probably not considered Jewish, but the Tzedokim were very, very strict adherence to the written word. And when one of them were to promise anything, to say anything in form of a commitment, no matter how crazy it is, no matter how difficult it would be to do, he has to do it. Because he does not recognize the oral Torah, which contains the process called Hatarat Nedarim, and he's stuck, even in ridiculous situations. Now let me tell you a personal anecdote first before I tell you something more serious from the Mishnah. My father, Zichron Olivracha, was a ordained rabbi, a very wise person, and a lawyer, and an accountant, and a teacher. But it's the lawyer that I am telling the story about. Many Pesach Eves, in those days, two of them for the Seder, my brothers and I, together or separately, would attempt to steal the Afikoman. And invariably, we managed to get possession of it. so that when my father came up to that point in the Seder, we went through the tradition of his saying, where's my Afikoman? And we would say, we have it, but we're not giving it to you unless you promise to give us things. So 1 year, or maybe more than 1 year, he said to me, what do you want? I said, a bicycle. He said, okay, no problem. And my other brother said he wanted a baseball glove. And my father said, no problem. And I don't remember what my little brother asked for, but my father again said, no problem. I promised to do it all. As he's eating the Afikoman, which we returned to him, he says, by the way, promises made under duress are invalid. So after we learned what the word duress meant, we all started to cry. And my mother, of course, calmed us down and said, don't worry, he'll give it to you. He's just, you know, showing you that he knows the law. Now that always stuck with me because of a Mishnah in Masechet Yoma. Masechet Yoma deals with the laws of Yom Kippur, both the Yom Kippur, which we observe annually, as well as the special service in the Beit HaMikdash on Yom Kippur when the Beit HaMikdash stands. And the very opening Mishnayot discuss taking the Kohen Gadol 1 week before Yom Kippur and sequestering him, or as we would say, isolating him or quarantining him, in a certain chamber of the Beit HaMikdash complex, where he would be protected from potential ritual impurity, which would invalidate him from doing the work on Yom Kippur, and during which time he met with scholars and elders of the Sanhedrin and of the Kohanim to review all of the procedures of the day, which were very complex. There was one procedure which we, I say we meaning Torah traditional Jews, had, and the Tzedokim did not accept, and they had a different one. And it involved a very sensitive part of the service in the Beit HaMikdash on Yom Kippur. The Kohen Gadol has to take a fire pan of gold, put hot coals from the golden altar in the Beit HaMikdash on it, and then take a fistful of incense, ketoret, sprinkle that onto the hot coals where they burn and produce a cloud of smoke in the whole Beit HaMikdash. And then he enters the Holy of Holies. The Tzedokim said, no, he enters the Holy of Holies first and then puts the incense on the coals so that the chamber of the Holy of Holies fills with smoke, but not necessarily the rest of the Beit HaMikdash. Now, this might sound like a trifling, but it is far from it. It is the difference between doing Seder Avodat Yom HaKippurim properly or improperly. It is a difference between the success of the Kohen Gadol and his failure. It is a difference between the atonement that Yom Kippur service affords for all of the Jewish people as opposed to the lack of that atonement. And therefore, the elders of Sanhedrin were in a quandary. During the time of the second Beit HaMikdash, it was not uncommon for a political appointee by either the Greeks and later by the Romans to become Kohen Gadol, which was meant to clash with the elders of Sanhedrin so that the Jews would keep themselves busy and not rebel, or whatever other reasons they had. Occasionally, we're talking about a legitimate Kohen who, when he put on the special garments of the Kohen Gadol, had the halachically acceptable status of Kohen Gadol, but he could have been a Tzedoki. And at that moment that the Kohen Gadol on Yom Kippur is to enter the Holy of Holies, no one is allowed to be present in the entire Beit HaMikdash. So unlike the rest of the day, he has other people around who can keep an eye on him and coach him if necessary and make sure he does the right thing. When he is about to enter the Holy of Holies, nobody sees him. And therefore there was a legitimate fear that he would do the Tzedoki system rather than the Torah way of doing it. So how do they solve this problem? They can't turn on video cameras and watch him, or have somebody hiding behind the Aron to watch him. They administered an oath. They made him swear that nothing, that he will do only that which he was told to do by the Sanhedrin people. That he may not deviate from it one tiny iota. Now, if he were not a Tzedoki, but decided to do something different because nobody's watching, an oath is not going to help. So he'll promise, and then he'll say, I promised, I was forced to promise, it didn't mean anything. But that doesn't work with a Tzedoki. A Tzedoki has lo yachel tvaro kechol hayotzei mipiv ya'aseh, and when he is forced by the Sanhedrin to make such a vow, we trust that he will do it properly, because in the things that Tzedokim do, like in this case adherence to an oath, they are extremely meticulous. Bottom line for us is that when we give our word for something, whether we said, I promise or not, I vow, I swear, in God's name, not in God's name, it doesn't matter. When a person gives his word for something, he is duty bound by the Torah to keep his word and not to profane it. With the exception of a situation which would become like an opening for him to say, well, I didn't mean to include that kind of situation, because I would have said at the beginning, if I thought of it, except for X, Y, or Z. And on that basis, a person can be unbound from his oath. And the power of Hatarat Nadarim is amazing. If a person makes a pledge not to eat chocolate chip cookies on Sunday, and he's at a gathering with social distancing and masks, of course, on Monday, and he absentmindedly takes a chocolate chip cookie and pops it into his mouth under his mask, then he has violated the Torah law of profaning his word. If on Tuesday he appears before a Beit Din and says to them, on Sunday I made a vow that I should never have made, I vowed against chocolate chip cookies, and I didn't mean it the way it sounded. I didn't mean it to include when I'm at a party, or I didn't mean it to include when I lose weight, or I control my urge for chocolate chip cookies, or I do it inadvertently. My mistake was not saying I won't eat chocolate chip cookies, b'li neder, without a vow. So I ask you, Hatara, to unbind me. What the Beit Din accomplishes on Tuesday is not mere forgiveness for the sin committed on Monday. It's an erasure of the vow from Sunday, which makes eating the chocolate chip cookie on Monday no sin at all. And this is one of the reasons given for our doing a formal kind of Hatarat Nedarim before Rosh Hashanah, and the Kol Nidre in different ways before Yom Kippur begins, because we want to be able to say to God, look, I created through my speech commitments, so many that I don't even remember them all, and I did Hatarat Nedarim to uproot those that can be uprooted from the beginning. That's how I would like you to erase my sins. You told me to not do something on Shabbat. I did it on Shabbat. Now I regret it, and I won't do it anymore, and I recognize that it's a sin, and I ask your forgiveness. So in that generalized situation, God forgives, but the sin is still there. On a deeper level, the sin could be erased also. And there's even a higher level or deeper level than that. We won't go into that now. But that's one of the reasons for doing Hatarat Nedarim around Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur time. We don't want these on our head when we are standing judgment before God. Now I have two more big topics that I want to get to. And right up front, I am accepting the idea that I'm not going to be able to do them both. And between the two, even though you've heard it more from me and others than the second one, I'm going to do it again. In the Parsha of Maaseh, what we did about Nedarim, or the opening psukim in Matot. In Maaseh, we have the command of V'horashtem et ha'aretz v'yishavtem ba. You shall conquer and settle the land and live in it. This is the Torah's command to dwell in the land of Israel. This and many other psukim reveal to us HaKadosh Baruch Hu, God's will, his ratzon, that the Jewish people live in the land of Israel. It isn't without strings attached. We have to behave properly and live a Torah life. And there are certain very, very gross violations and betrayals of God that have earned us exile. But he wants us to be in Israel. And therefore, it should be a no-brainer. I mean, this is what Kalev and Yehoshua said when the Meraglim had their negative talk about Israel. And Kalev was extremely lucid by saying, hey guys, if this is what God wants us to do, you think he would not help us succeed? But the people didn't listen. At least the adult males didn't listen. So when the Torah commands settling, conquering, settling, and living in the land of Israel, comes the Ramban Nachmanides, Rabbi Moshe ben Nachman, and says this is one of the 613 mitzvot in the Torah, to live in Israel. And it applies at all times. And that means that throughout Jewish history, from the destruction of the Beit HaMikdash, it was always an imperative for Jews to live in Israel. It was never forbidden to a Jew not to live here. There were restrictions, however, at certain times about coming en masse and forcibly taking over the land. Those are known as the oaths that were administered on us. And some other time we'll go through that topic as to why they don't apply today. But the desire of God, and says the Ramban, the mitzvah of the Torah, which is confirmed in several other places, is this is what God commands us and what he wants from us. Now, aside from the Ramban, there are many, many people in the period after the Talmud of the Gaonim and Rishonim, who counted the 613 mitzvot. The problem was that we had a tradition, very old tradition, that there are 613 mitzvot in the Torah, and that we accepted as a given, and nobody listed what they were until the Gaonim. And lo and behold, their lists of 613 mitzvot did not match. There were many, many in common, but there were also several, quite a number, that counters of mitzvot disagreed as to whether they should be counted as a mitzvah at all, or whether they should be combined with other mitzvot, and all the different kind of reasons to put it on your list or not to put it on your list. Of all the counters of mitzvot, by far, the two most popular are the Rambam Maimonides and the Sefer HaChinuch, which almost exactly follows the Rambam. There's two mitzvot that they differ on. The Ramban has many, many more differences. And one of the famous ones is Yishuv Eretz Yisrael. That there's a mitzvah in the Torah. Ramban says one of the 613 for a Jew to live in Israel. Rambam does not have it on his list, nor does Sefer HaChinuch. So there are people who want to argue, and I've heard them to my face, well, if the Rambam didn't count it as a mitzvah, then even though the Ramban did, I mean, we follow the Rambam more. And he didn't count it as a mitzvah, so it's not an imperative. You open up the Rambam, Mishneh Torah, that's his book of halacha, and you see there in one of the last chapters of the whole work that a person shall always live in the land of Israel, even in a city, the majority of whose inhabitants are not Jewish, rather than live outside of Israel in a city, the majority of whose inhabitants are Jewish. And we could make that even sharper by saying, rather to live in a town in Israel where they worship idols than live outside of Israel, even in a very, very religious neighborhood. So you also have to know that this was not the Rambam's original opinion. He is quoting almost verbatim from the Gemara. And the Gemara has no one that argues on it, that a person who lives in Eretz Yisrael is like one who has a god, and a Jew who lives in Chutz La'aretz is like someone who doesn't have a god. Very, very sharp statements. So it's very difficult to say the Rambam didn't think it was such an important mitzvah, and that's why he didn't put it in the 613. Now, there are different reasons that are given, and I'm not giving you an objective survey of them, but I will tell you this. There is a concept that, and not a good way to start, the word supra, S-U-P-R-A, that's not a word, that's a prefix, not super, but supra means above. The mitzvah of dwelling in Israel is a supra mitzvah because it's a mitzvah by itself, because it facilitates many mitzvot that can only be performed in the land of Israel, because it adds a significant quality to the performance of every single mitzvah. So one can say that the Rambam's approach would be, there's a mitzvah to keep Shabbat in Israel. Now that mitzvah goes all over the world, but the real solid mitzvah is to keep Shabbat in the place where God wants the Jewish people to live. And the same thing for saying Birkat HaMazon after a meal, and the same thing for observing Sukkot. Mitzvot were purposely given at Sinai, which is outside the boundaries of Israel, so that Jews, wherever they are, have to know that they are bound to the mitzvot. But the Ramban puts it in a very sharp way. He said the reason that Jews outside of Israel do mitzvot is to keep in shape, to practice. When you keep Shabbat in Chutz La'aretz, you are practicing how to keep Shabbat where it really belongs in Israel. When you say Birkat HaMazon, and you sing Kakatu V'yachalta B'savato V'rachta T'Hashem Elokecha Al Ha'aretz HaTova Asher Natan Lach, it's kind of strange that Birkat HaMazon is done in Chutz La'aretz, but it certainly doesn't have the quality of someone in Israel saying Birkat HaMazon. Now, I'm not suggesting that just because you're in Israel, your mitzvot are performed on a higher level than people in Chutz La'aretz. If it's someone in Chutz La'aretz that has a lot of kavanah and puts a lot of feeling into the bracha and gets a lot of joy, not the bracha, the mitzvah, and gets a lot of joy out of doing the mitzvah, and someone who lives here who just goes through the motions, then certainly the one doing it in Chutz La'aretz has a superior performance of mitzvot. But if everything else is equal, if the enthusiasm is there, if the kavanah is there, if the sheer joy and love of God is there, then doing that mitzvah, whatever mitzvah it is here in Eretz Yisrael, is better than doing it in Chutz La'aretz. I tend to get very strong and pushy. I once got a letter from, I won't say who, referring to me as a bully and telling me that Torah Tidbits was not the place to bully people. It was a place for Divrei Torah. And I defended myself by saying, I'm not a bully. I am telling you Divrei Torah. You know, if a person speaks about some of the details of Shmirat Shabbat, Sabbath observance, to someone who doesn't want to keep Shabbos or finds it hard to keep Shabbos, you're not being a bully. You're telling him what he's supposed to do. Do you have to be sympathetic if he doesn't? Yeah. I always divide between people in Chutz La'aretz, Jews in Chutz La'aretz, who have legitimate excuses or even not such legitimate excuses. There's a myriad of reasons. Top of my list is not dividing families and the issue of livelihood, parnasa. But there are many other kind of issues as well. But my bone to pick, not on Leil HaSeder from the Korban Pesach, but any other time, my bone to pick is with the people who say, I have everything that I need here in, you fill in the name of a neighborhood, so why should I go through the difficulty of making aliyah? I have everything that I need. And I say, you sound exactly like the 10 Meraglim who were struck dead by God for saying that we have everything we need for a full Torah life here in the Midbar. We have protection from by the heavenly clouds of glory. We have food that falls from the heavens, and all we need to do is collect it. We have water that miraculously accompanies us on our travels. We have clothes that don't wear out, shoes that don't wear out, clothes that grow and increase in size as we do. And we have Torah. We have the proximity to Har Sinai. We have the access to Moshe Rabbeinu and a whole system of education. What more do we need? Says God. You need to come out of the protective womb and be born into the land of Israel where my people, the Jewish people, belong. Now, I think I'll do all of you or some of you a favor and not continue on this, although it's a topic that gets me very heated up. The example that I always use, which I mentioned already, is we have everything we need in so-and-so for a complete Jewish life. And I once was said to my face, I said, what do you mean? You have shuls? Oh, yeah, plenty of shuls. And schools? Yeah, schools. And mikveh? Sure. And Shomer Shabbos restaurants? Oh, yeah. And kosher shopping? Oh, yeah. And mikveh? Oh, of course. And Eretz Yisrael, what do you mean? I said, what do you mean, what do I mean? You said you have everything you need for a complete Jewish life. It is not a complete Jewish life without the land of Israel. It is not a complete Jewish life without the Beit HaMikdash. And with that, Jews outside of Israel and us in Israel share. Because we don't yet have the Beit HaMikdash. But if you're able to do part of it, if you're able not to have to violate Shabbat because you ended up with a job that you can feed your family and keep Shabbat, go for it. And if you're able to keep kosher, I'm talking about Jews in the middle of the 1950s, the 1900s, or even before, where in America it was a common phenomenon that you had Jews who davened three times a day, talis and tefillin in the morning, and they went to work on Shabbat after an early minyan that they davened at. And they lamented it, and they cried about it, but they could not support their family at that time without violating the Shabbat. I am not judging them, but I am saying that today, Aliyah is easier and easier to do. Nefesh B'Nefesh has been a tremendous help to ease the klita, the absorption of immigrants into the country. The country, the state of Israel, is extremely accommodating with all kind of rights. I mean, the least of which is a free ticket here. But there's much, much more. Tax breaks and all kind of other things. And even if it's hard, this is where the Jewish people belong. When someone will argue with me, oh, so-and-so paskin that it's not a mitzvah chiyuvit, it's not an obligation, but it's a mitzvah chiyumit, that you get a mitzvah when you do it, I say, is that where you draw the line? You only perform mitzvot that you're obligated to do and not mitzvot that are able to be performed so you'll do it? I said, you wear a talis and a talis katan, don't you? Well, the putting of strings on the four corners of your garments is not an obligation unless you wear a four-cornered garment. So if you go through life without a four-cornered garment, which today's standard of dressing usually doesn't include anyway, then you never have the mitzvah as an obligation. Came our sages and said, no, we obligate you to wear a four-cornered garment so that you will be able to fulfill this special mitzvah of tzitzit. The state of Israel was established, not that they weren't people who came before, but its reason for existence is to facilitate the return to Eretz Yisrael of Jews from all over the world. And many have come, and many, many have not come. I think enough said, maybe more than enough, and I will finish with my traditional greeting of Shabbat Shalom. But also because we bench Rosh Chodesh this Shabbat, I will say Chodesh Tov, and Av is a Chodesh Tov. Only the first third is part of the morning of the Beit HaMikdash. Right after, or even on the afternoon of Tisha B'Av, the concept of Nechama, comfort, is entering, and then Shabbat Nachamu, and then a whole period of Nechama as we prepare for the Yamim Noraim coming at the after Elul. So, Shabbat Shalom, Chodesh Tov, L'hish Tameya.
Atah, Atah, Yeshua.